Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is genius and where does it come from? We have long been fascinated by those capable of seemingly superhuman creative and intellectual feats. But as my guest today will tell us, our beliefs about the source of those gifts and the potential to use them for good or evil has evolved over many centuries of Western history. Darren M. McMahon is Ben Wider, professor of history at Florida State University. His new book is called Divine Fury, A History of Genius. Darren, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's great to be here.
Where does the word genius come from?
So the word genius is an old one. It's a Latin term. We have recorded records of it from at least the 2nd century BC. In Latin, it was probably pronounced genius, and it referred not to an individual of extraordinary creative or intellectual power, but to a kind of spirit or god. The Romans had the belief that all males had a tutelary spirit, kind of like a guardian angel that they called a genius, who was a god of birth, who attended you from birth to death, who watched over you, took care of you, and acted as an intercessor between you and the gods.
So some people just had a really awesome genius?
Yeah. Everyone honored their genius. In fact, one of the things I always tell students is that our notion of a birthday cake and a birthday celebration is probably the last vestige of the Roman cult of honoring your god of birth on the birthday. The Romans would provide a little cake and maybe light some candles and, you know, burn some incense, pour out a libation of wine on the birthday. And our birthday cake with candles is the kind of last vestige of that. But yes, the genius is also a way of thinking about one's personality. It's a kind of spiritual embodiment of your character. And so the idea was that great individuals had great genii in the plural. One of the greatest of the ancient world was Socrates, not a Roman, of course, a Greek. But the Greeks, too, had a notion of divine spirits or tutelary spirits that the Romans later called genii. The Greeks called demons or daimon. And the notion in the ancient world was that Socrates, who was widely reputed to be the wisest of the ancients, had a particularly powerful daimon or demon, his daimonion, it was called, his little demon spirit, who warned him before he did something incorrect, who whispered the language of the gods into his ear, and so he had a kind of direct line into the divine world.
But he would have been seen as a vessel of those gifts rather than someone who was particularly special as an individual?
Well, it depends on who you ask, but yes, the notion develops, and in fact my title, Divine Fury, refers to this. Divine Fury or Mania is a phrase that Plato uses when he's talking about poets and prophets and other people who are filled with what he says is a kind of a divine madness infused by the gods that whips the individual into a kind of ecstatic state, allowing them to make extraordinary pronouncements and to write great things. Now, Plato famously doesn't like poets. He recognizes that they have tremendous power and power over language, but as a consequence, he's sort of disparaging them in his accounts of this. And so he is saying that, yes, you know, this poet or prophet has nothing of his own. He's simply getting a gift from the gods, and he is an empty vessel. There is, though, a contrasting view that Aristotle develops, among others in the ancient world, that extraordinary individuals have something natural, and indeed what is natural is best, what is comes in them with birth is superior to anything that might be learned or acquired over the course of a lifetime.
And Aristotle's idea was that this was just a really good balance of humors, is that right?
Well, yes. The view was long attributed to Aristotle based on a writing called The Problems, and we now know that the particular writing was probably written by somebody else, one of his students, and so it's called the pseudo-Aristotelian problems. But yes, there's a passage in that book in which the pseudo-Aristotle says, you know, why is it that individuals of great eminence, of extraordinary capacity, whether that's poetry or generalship or statecraft or what have you, seem to have or seem to be subject to melancholy. Melancholy literally meaning black bile, and there's an ancient understanding that all constitutions are made up by a certain configuration of the humors. We talk to this day about people as being sanguine, right? Optimistic, having too much blood, or melancholy, sad, having too much black bile. And so what Aristotle is suggesting, and this gets developed in an ancient medical literature, and then this is revived in the early modern period, is suggesting that extraordinary individuals have a similar constitution, that they have a kind of similar physiology, as we would say, and that on the one hand, this is a great thing, but on the other hand, there are side effects, right? A tendency to madness, to instability, to irrationality.
You know, reading about that, I was thinking about the differences today in how even now in Western culture, we think of genius as something that is sort of inborn. You know, now, of course, we have different understandings of how the brain works. But if you look at Eastern cultures, there are still many places where the idea is that if you want to be the best at something, it really is about hard work rather than being sort of touched by some kind of special physiological gift.
That's right. And one of the things that I try to show in the book is that when the cult of geniuses as particularly special individuals really gets going in the 18th century, there's this long backstory that I talk about, but really the cult of the genius emerges in the 18th century roughly with people like Newton and Voltaire and Goethe and Benjamin Franklin, Napoleon, and so forth. When it gets going, in part, the work it's doing, the cultural work of it's doing, is replacing an older notion of saints or extraordinary divine individuals. Because of that, there's an association to divine or religious power, but there's also the idea that these individuals can't be touched by the gods or gods anymore because people are starting to discountenance these ideas of, you know, demons and spirits and so forth. So it must be born, that individual genius must be born. And that's the dominant understanding that holds, as you suggest, to really until this day. I have a colleague here at Florida State by the name of Anders Ericsson, who's a world-class psychologist, and in fact, whose ideas Malcolm Gladwell developed in his last, not the most recent book, the one before, Outliers. Mm. You've probably heard this idea of the 10,000-hour rule, that,
right,
you know, people like Mozart were really good at what they did because they had, they just practiced more and they worked harder. I think there's a lot of value to thinking about superior performance or genius, as we call it, in those terms, but as you suggest, it's still not the norm. We like to think of geniuses as special beings by birth, and I think I would argue that we have a kind of psychological investment as well as other kinds of investments in thinking of individuals like this.
Well, and the thing about the 10,000-hour rule is that you have to have extraordinary drive, and who knows where it comes from, but in order to commit to those hours of practice, there has to be something different about you than other people.
Right, and so you can bring it back to birth, and I would argue that there is probably something to that. I mean, you know, I'm a professor, all professors and teachers know that, you know, you can stand over a student and say work as until you're blue in the face, but unless they have that inner drive, that inner capacity to apply themselves, it's often very hard to make a student or a child do what you want them to.
So at that point in the Enlightenment, when there was a sense that you know, people like Isaac Newton were special, but in a different way than they had been in the past, we still needed to revere them. And even, you know, the way that his body was treated after he died, he was essentially a secular saint.
Exactly. And I think that's just really the way of thinking about it. I mean, think about Newton. Here's a person who, like Einstein later, is literally able to see into the fabric of the universe, right? He has a kind of extraordinary vision that allows him to see God's work. And, of course, he was understood at the time, and he understood himself as doing just that. Newton was a devout Christian, and he believed literally that he was sort of unlocking God's world and then permitting others to see into God's world. And so even though Newton is not treated as a religious figure in an older sense, as a saint, he's accorded sort of saintly or divine powers. And this accompanies the cult of genius right from the very beginning. Another way, and this applies to Newton, it also applies to somebody like Shakespeare or Napoleon. Shakespeare, of course, is an older writer, and yet he's only referred to as a genius in the 18th century. And he comes to be seen as a sort of embodiment or voice of the English people. He is Englishness incarnate. Napoleon does the same for France, Goethe for Germany, Benjamin Franklin, arguably, or later Edison, for the United States. And that capacity to sort of reconcile and to embody a national voice or a national will is, again, akin to an older sort of religious type, a prophet or saint, and these figures, as a consequence, have tremendous power.
Well, for anyone to serve as an embodiment of one's entire nation or culture, there's also a lot that depends on being born at the right time and having these special gifts. You know, one wonders if an Einstein had been born in the 12th century, he might have been amazing, but we might not remember his name today. To what extent is every genius a product of the time and place in which he or she is born?
Sure, I think place is extraordinarily important. I mean, you know, it's a kind of sad thought to think how many great, creative, brilliant individuals have died in wastelands and, you know, on the African veld and so on and so forth, and whose power has never been tapped. The circumstances have to be right. In fact, there are theorists who begin to develop this in the 18th century. I talk about one in particular, a French guy by the name of Helvétius, who says exactly that, you know, genius is about timing. And we know, for example, that you take a Darwin, an extraordinary figure to be sure, but we know that, you know, hot on Darwin's heels were other people who were developing a similar notion of adaptation, evolution, natural selection. And Darwin got there more or less first. Same with Einstein. As extraordinary as Einstein was, we would have gotten to relativity in due course. He had, in addition to other gifts, good timing.
I want to step back just for a minute here and talk about ideas about genius during the time of the Renaissance, when there was such a great blossoming of human creativity, or at least we see that there was a great blossoming, and those artifacts remain for us to examine.
Right. I present the Renaissance in the book as a kind of, you know, first step in the direction of a modern notion of genius. I think it's natural for many people to think about somebody like Leonardo or Michelangelo or Raphael or the greats of the 15th and 16th centuries as geniuses. And there's a reason for that, in part, in that in the early 19th century, the Romantics, who were very invested in a cult of genius, see themselves in the Renaissance. And so Romantic artists and writers write about people like Michelangelo as being geniuses. And, you know, they seem to have some of the characteristics. Michelangelo, you know, will work so long that he forgets to take his boots off and they literally stick to his feet. He's somewhat irascible. He's slightly manic. He seems to be prone to depression. And yet I would argue that even Michelangelo, as great as he was and as great as contemporaries recognize that he was, is not treated in the way that modern geniuses are. And there's an important reason for that. And the reason is that the modern notion of genius is very invested in the idea of intellectual originality. Wordsworth will say, the great English poet Wordsworth will say in the early 19th century, that genius is bringing something new into the intellectual universe. And that's just part and parcel of the way we think now about genius and really how we think about ideas in general, right? We have a whole intellectual copyright law that, in fact, develops very much out of this cult of genius in the 18th century to protect original ideas and original creation. One of the things I try to show in the book is that prior to the 18th century, people didn't think of any ideas as being original in the sense that all ideas either had endured from time immemorial in a world or universe that was eternal, or, as in the Jewish and Christian understandings, they'd endured with God from the creation of the universe. There's a theological maxim in the Christian tradition that says, solus Deus creat, God alone creates. And the idea is that God is the creator omnium. God has created or thought about every idea that exists in the world. And so to recreate an idea or to imitate idea is to recover or go back to that original creation, but is not to bring something new into the universe. In the Renaissance, they still are very much invested in this mimetic notion. And so to think of Michelangelo as an entirely original creator in a modern way is still a bit of a stretch.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Darren M. McMahon. His new book is called Divine Fury, A History of Genius. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Darren M. McMahon, professor of history at Florida State University and author of the new book, Divine Fury, A History of Genius. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. You were saying before the break, Darren, that there was this question of whether genius was about bringing something new into the world that had not existed before, or revealing something that sort of God had placed in the universe to be discovered.
Exactly. And I bet you were shocked that a professor just kept talking. Sorry about that. Got carried away. But yes, one easy way to kind of get a handle on that idea is to look at the etymology of words like discover. We think of discover now as, you know, a new discovery, but until the 18th century, it really had the kind of root meaning, which is to discover, to take the cover away, to reveal something that may have been hidden or lost, but was already there. The same is true of a word like invent or invention. In German and in Latin, the root is to find or to come upon, erfinden in German. So to come upon something that's already there, and that's the dominant notion that all ideas, that all art is about mimesis, about tracing or copying, imitating the perfect forms that have already existed. And as a consequence, to copy something wasn't necessarily bad. It's only when you get the idea that individuals are bringing something entirely new into creation that you get a development of a copyright, a conception of copyright, and the idea that to imitate or to copy is really to steal.
What kinds of obligations have we expected of our geniuses over the centuries?
Well, one of the things that I try to argue in the book, as I've already suggested a little bit, is that the cult of genius emerges in its modern form in the 18th century to do a kind of religious work, right? In a world that's less comfortable with spirits and angels and saints, that's less quick to assume that God intervenes on a daily basis in the world. I talk about what philosophers sometimes refer to as the notion of a withdrawal of God, the idea that God, while he or she may still exist, is nonetheless less present in the world on a daily basis. And so, as a consequence, people feel a kind of sense of abandonment or sense of void opening up. And I try to show that modern geniuses step into that space, and serve some of the roles that prophets, that saints, that even angels had served in previous centuries. So what do they do? Well, geniuses can see into the heart, into the soul, or into the fabric of the universe in ways that others can't. Geniuses can create, had it always been a kind of attribute of God. They can bring new things into the universe. Geniuses can prophesy in a modern way, right? Think of somebody like Karl Marx, who was very much hailed as a genius in the 19th century, despite the fact that he scoffed at the cult of genius. He's seen as somebody literally who can forecast the future development of humanity. And so these are some of the powers that geniuses have, in addition to what we already talked about, the genius being able to embody the genius populi, the genius of the people, to somehow speak for and incarnate and channel larger national ethnic yearnings.
And I guess along the same lines that we say God made man in his own image, if you have a human genius, you can look at that individual and recognize at least some things that you have in common. Not to get too flip about it, but they still put their pants on one leg at a time.
Right, and in fact, that's something that I trace in the book, because I have an opening chapter on the kind of pagan conceptions, classical conceptions of creation and of brilliance, or what we would call genius, and I show how these ideas get Christianized. And one of the things that's very interesting is, of course, there is this mandate in the Gospels to be perfect as I am perfect, right? To aspire to be Christ-like, which is really an injunction to aspire to be like God, which is on the one hand the highest the highest calling of a Christian. On the other hand, there's something dangerous about it. It's, of course, that is the temptation of the serpent in the Garden of Eden. The snake says, you know, be perfect. You can be like a god, right? You can be godlike. And so to aspire to being godlike is at once the most sacred aspiration, and it's also fraught with danger, the danger of temptation, the danger that someone like Faust will fall into in the myth and reality.
And we have, over time, allowed our geniuses to get away with things that we would not allow ourselves or other mere mortals to do.
Exactly. So on the one hand, there's this long-standing association with a kind of irrationality, a kind of madness. This goes back to the ancient world. Also this idea that, you know, to be divinely touched or to be divinely infused, to have a god using you as a vessel can open you up to possession, to demonic possession that might lead you in the wrong way. So Faust, in aspiring to total knowledge, godlike knowledge, falls into the clutches of the devil. But there's also this idea, as you suggest, that begins in the 18th century. If geniuses bring something new into the universe, one thing they're not doing is following the rules, right? Mm. The rules of art or the rules of society in ways that everyone else has done. Geniuses are rebels. They're rule breakers. They do new things. The Romantics take this idea and really run with it in the 19th century. And in fact, one of the things that's interesting is that you get a whole kind of romanticization of crime and criminal genius, right? If you remember Sherlock Holmes, his great nemesis is Moriarty, who's talked about as the Napoleon of crime, a kind of genius of the mind, right? He uses his brilliance to transgress in some ways. That idea gets developed in the 19th century. In fact, there's a whole science that links, or pseudoscience, as we'd now say, that links genius and a penchant for moral turpitude or corruption or crime together directly. But it follows from this idea that geniuses, they don't follow the rules in the way that ordinary human beings do, and as a consequence, they break them.
And I guess once we accept that genius is a human, potentially a human quality, then they're going to embody the best in us, but they will also at times embody the worst in us.
Right. I mean, this is something that was actually kind of surprising to me when I got into the project more fully, because I tend to associate genius predominantly with the good, and I think that's by and large how people think about genius today. And yet, there's this long association with evil, and as I try to show in the book, it culminates, you know, rather frighteningly at the beginning of the 20th century in a cult of evil genius.
Where have we historically drawn the line between great skill or great accomplishment and true genius?
That's an interesting question, and I wish I had a quick, canned answer for you. Where does the line get drawn? Well, let me answer it this way. In the 18th century, people are really start to, you know, ask the question, what is genius? How to define it? How to identify it? And they begin to draw a distinction, an invidious distinction that gets played out of the 19th century and that you still hear today. The distinction is between genius and talent, right? And the idea, Schopenhauer, the German philosopher, has a line where he says, you know, a talented individual can learn how to hit a target with a bow and arrow at, you know, X number of meters. He said a genius can see a target that ordinary mortals can't. Mm. There's a qualitative distinction between talent, which can be learned and acquired, and genius, which is inherent, which is born, which is just there. You either have it or you don't. That is how people draw that line. I think that line is much more fluid than we want to assume, and yet that's how it gets drawn from the 18th century, and that's held until relatively recently.
To what extent have different eras recognized any sort of burden that goes along with genius?
I think this accompanies the cult of genius from the very beginning, and in part this has to do with it's a religious association. If geniuses are like saints, then or prophets, they suffer for their gifts. This gets romanticized by the Romantics, who have really a whole cult of suffering and the suffering that geniuses will endure, including madness. One of the people I write about is the Renaissance poet Tasso. Tasso is somebody who's a great hero to the Romantics, and this is another example of the Romantics going back to the Renaissance and finding geniuses there. But Tasso is imprisoned because of his madness. And so for the Romantics, that's a kind of perfect symbol of the suffering that geniuses undergo. They're prone to madness. They're also prone to misunderstanding by those around them, because geniuses are so far in front of their ahead of their time that their contemporaries will look at them often as outliers, as extremes, as kind of strange. And so that idea of the genius being uncomfortable, being queer, peculiar, original, in the older sense of, you know, slightly odd, has accompanied the notion from fairly early on.
So the Nazis, of course, had all kinds of really twisted obsessions. Among them was this idea of genius and the cult of genius. How did that obsession contribute to the ability of a person like Hitler to carry out these really diabolical plans that he formed?
Right. So, and this is another, you know, I think some surprising theme that emerges from the book, but it's absolutely central. Germans and Germany are invested in a cult of genius very heavily from the early part of the 19th century forward. And Adolf Hitler, as a, you know, failed art student, is sort of, you know, attuned to that, what the Germans call Genie Gedanke, a kind of discourse or thought about genius. And he actually uses it very strategically from early on. He presents himself, as improbable as that seems to us today, as a genius, and he's received as such. He writes about it at genius at some length in Mein Kampf. He spins and plays his early failures to his advantage, because if, in this understanding that I just laid out, a genius will be misunderstood in the early phases of the genius's life, then, well, Hitler was misunderstood when he was an aspiring art student or architecture student, and he's only kind of comes into his genius in a later point in his life. If the genius is prone to madness or to instability, well, Hitler has this in spades. Hitler breaks rules, right? Hitler does things that other people wouldn't aspire to do, and Hitler, as he's presented in his propaganda, and it, you know, he does fairly successfully in his oratory, seems to channel or embody the German spirit. So he's able to use this pre-existing cult of genius to his advantage and present himself as a genius. And then the Nazis, when he comes into power, go to great lengths to associate Hitler with the great figures of German genius in the past, to present Hitler as the genius who embodies the voice of the German people and who can save them, who can redeem them, who can do this quote-unquote religious work for the German people that only a genius can do.
I suppose Hitler also benefited from the fact that even in the modern era, although it turns out to be sort of a false assumption, when someone is acknowledged to be brilliant at one thing, we tend to assume they will be brilliant at everything else. So you might be an amazing mathematician, but that doesn't mean that you're good at managing your own money, that sort of thing.
Exactly. In fact, I write about this at some length, because going all the way back to this ancient notion of the humors that we talked about earlier with Aristotle, there's this assumption that genius or superior ability is a thing, is a reified thing, and that, as you say, will apply across the board. So if you have genius, you're born with genius, then you could be a great poet if you choose to put your energy that way, but also a great statesman and so forth. One of the great things, and I write at some length about Einstein as in kind of, you know, the antithesis of Hitler, one of the great things about Einstein is that he recognizes this fully, and, you know, he's asked to be president of Israel at the end of his life, and he writes back and says, you know, I'm honored, and of course he's very much a supporter of Israel, and yet he says, look, you know, just because I'm a great physicist and mathematician doesn't mean I have any knowledge of statecraft. That
right.
does not follow. And so he recognized that and denies that, and I think that's an important reminder. I think we're still prone to assume that, you know, because somebody's a great actor, say, means that they have, you know, insightful things to say about politics or about any number of other things, and that just does not follow.
It's a really beautiful example of humility on Einstein's part, because it would seem that a lot of people would sort of hit the ground running and take whatever they could get in order to profit from what they felt they had contributed to the world.
Absolutely. And, you know, of course, Einstein is not above, and I think, you know, justifiably so, using his celebrity and his genius to stump for causes he believed in and cared in, but he doesn't cross that line in the same way that others do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Harvey in Parker. Hi, Harvey.
How you doing, Chris?
Very well, thank you.
Okay, I listened to your description of genius, and I had to smile because I'm a great big fan of Temple Grandin's. And what you were describing was autism, and how that, if you think about it, you know, being socially inept is part of the mind being wired different. And if you look at somebody that's a savant, or even you know, just somebody that's in low end of the spectrum as far as being, they see things differently. And we assume that that's genius when it really is just a mind that's wired different.
That's really interesting. What do you think about that, Darren?
Yeah, thank you for that wonderful comment and question, Harvey. There's no question that there's this long association, as I say, between a kind of obsession, a social dysfunction, and genius. And, you know, research continues into the relationship. I tend to be somewhat skeptical of the association between sort of genius and madness, or a kind of emotional instability, except maybe in some fields. People sometimes point out, for example, that poets seem to show a kind of disposition to a kind of instability, and that may follow naturally from what it is that makes great poets great. What do poets do? They make metaphor. They draw associations between dissimilar things. If you go out another standard deviation or two on that same path, you get schizophrenia, right? A kind of bringing together of things that really are dissimilar, right, that don't connect. But I think that being a savant and being a genius are different things, in part because there's this emphasis on creation and creativity and original creativity. Savants can often do incredible calculations, in the same way that prodigies can play extraordinary pieces on the piano or violin, but what they usually can't do is bring new things into creation, right? Mozart's only really honored as a genius fully with his creative work as an adult. When he's a child prodigy, he's seen as a wonderful pianist and kind of an amusement figure and maybe a budding genius, but you've got to do the production first to prove it.
My guest is Darren M. McMahon. He is professor of history at Florida State University and author of the new book Divine Fury, A History of Genius. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with a history professor at Florida State University, Darren M. McMahon. His new book is called Divine Fury, A History of Genius. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Darren, in many ways throughout history, our ability to identify a genius has been a little bit like, you know, identifying obscene content in the media. We know it when we see it, right? But in the early 20th century, we started getting really focused on ways that we might objectively quantify genius. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And in fact, the search precedes the early 20th century. The big development of the early 20th century is the IQ exam. And what I try to show in the book is that the IQ really grows out of a whole century's worth of what I call genealogy, G-E-N-I-O-L-O-G-Y, I spell it, the science of genius. And so with the emergence of the cult of genius in the 18th century, there's this great desire to quantify it, to be able to detect it, to be able to measure it. And this leads to some really kind of kooky science. It begins with physiognomy, right? The idea that you could somehow read genius in the face. And we, you know, sort of laugh at this now, but it was big stuff at the end of the 18th century. And in fact, it endures into the early 20th century. I draw attention to a German psychologist by the name of Ernst Kretschmer, who's actually nominated for a Nobel Prize in 1929, who writes a book in the early 30s purporting to show how genius registers in the facial features of individuals. So there's physiognomy, there's also craniometry and phrenology, the effort to kind of look at and measure the skull as an index of what lies below it in the brain, which is implicated in a kind of whole racial and racist understanding of human development, the idea that, you know, somehow men have bigger brains than women and white men have the biggest brains of all, and this is a kind of insidious science, but it's big business in the 19th century. There's also this even wackier theory that's called degeneration theory that carried out mainly by doctors and psychologists who want to draw a link between genius and madness, and so start trying to chronicling the sicknesses, the illness, the neuroses, the strangeness of genius. And the wonderful example I love of this is the great French novelist Émile Zola, who's convinced that he's a genius but is not sure if he's mad, has himself examined by a whole group of accredited French psychologists who rule that at the end of the day he's slightly neurotic. In other words, he's neurotic enough to be a genius, but, you know, he can still kind of get along day to day. And so,
It's all any of us could hope for, right?
Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jim in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Oh, thank you, dear. Yeah, I think that the definition here should be much more pointed. I think genius is just a matter of facility, and people who have the brains that are make it easier for them to gather and to associate information are potentially geniuses, and the only thing that usually mitigates that is the fact of their environment in some fashion and trauma and things like that. But if they clear the barriers and get through their, especially their adolescence, without being completely baffled by life, like their brains seem to function just beautifully, and they become what I consider geniuses. And I think it.
Thanks for your call, Jim. You know, the interesting thing about what Jim had to say, and I don't necessarily disagree, is that genius level IQ, at least, appears to be no predictor of you know, productivity in life necessarily.
Right, and I think that's really important. I like to draw attention to the work of Francis Galton, who is really, as you may know, the father of eugenics. He creates eugenics as a scientist, but he's also deeply interested in genius, and he writes his first book called Hereditary Genius on just this subject. And he's one of these genealogists that I talk about. He's trying to figure out how to measure genius and how to identify it. And one of the things he says about genius is that, A, it's born, and he's absolutely convinced that there's a kind of, you know, basis in the blood. He doesn't yet have an understanding of genetic endowment, but he thinks it's inherited. And two, that it involves not only superior aptitude or capacity, intelligence, as we'd say, or creativity, but also the ability to carry that out, right? In other words, the kind of gumption and the hard work. And so in Galton's view, part of being a genius is overcoming the obstacles, is overcoming the barriers. And if you don't do that, then maybe you don't have genius. Now, I don't share that idea, but that's the dominant one in the culture for some time.
Hmm. We have an interesting quote here sent in by Sam in Fort Worth. Sam says, the writer Janet Flanner, who wrote The Letter from Paris reports for The New Yorker for 50 years, said that the difference between genius and talent is that genius is immediate, talent takes time.
See, that's, you know, I think this is indicative of this older, you know, invidious distinction, right? That you know, talent's okay, fine, but, you know, you or I could do it if we really worked at it hard enough, and genius is something special. This was used, that distinction was used by Hitler and the Nazis to discredit Jews, because of course you had the emergence of, you know, extraordinary Jewish achievement at the beginning of the 20th century. Jews are winning Nobel Prizes completely out of proportion to their size in the population. They seem to be doing extremely well on IQ exams, as Galton and others will begin to appreciate. And so how to explain this? And the way Hitler and the Nazis explain is that the Jews have talent. They're clever, right? They steal other people's ideas, and they practice really hard, and they're good. Wagner says this about Jewish music, which is a double slight, and Wagner's another important figure in my book. It's a double slight because we know that Wagner borrowed essential ideas from Jewish composers and then kind of slapped them in the back. You'll sometimes, even today, still hear that invidious distinction drawn in a kind of racist way vis-a-vis Asians, you know, that Asian musicians are somehow very good at taking other ideas and practicing really hard, but they don't have the stuff itself. And I, you know, I find that idea repulsive, and I think we want to be real cautious of that distinction.
Are there remnants of Calvinism in the way that we think about genius today?
Well, that's interesting. And in fact, I do write at some length in the book on how the developing notion of genius sort of tracks with both Catholic and Protestant understandings of grace. And as you know, in the Calvinist conception and Protestant conception, you either have grace or you don't. And there's nothing you can do to get it. No amount of works, no amount of, you know, spending time at the soup kitchen will get you grace. It's God has made that decision already. And of course, the Catholic understanding is somewhat different, according a role to human work, human effort. And I think that that does track in some interesting ways with the notion of genius that emerges, perhaps not coincidentally, first and foremost in Britain and Germany in the 17th and 18th centuries, Protestant countries at least in part, and the idea that genius is something that, that you either have or you don't.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Sam on the line in Frisco. Hi, Sam.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I was wondering if there is any relationship between being genius and believer and non-believer. And if there is, what's the percentage?
I don't have any figures on that, to be perfectly honest. What I can tell you is that in part because of the association that gets drawn between religion and genius beginning in the 18th century, is that religious apologists and religious polemicists begin to draw attention to religious figures as geniuses. So you get a literature in the 19th century that continues in some parts of the country to the present day describing Jesus as a genius or St. Paul as a genius or other religious figures as a genius. Martin Luther, the leader of the Protestant Reformation, is described in Germany frequently as a genius. And this is such a kind of widespread discourse and language that the great Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard writes an essay in the middle of the 19th century, which is entitled On the Difference Between a Genius and an Apostle. And he says, you know, it's sacrilegious to describe somebody like St. Paul as a genius. Genius is a human attribute, and being an apostle is something different. He wants to draw a line between the two. So there's certainly a discussion of that, but how many geniuses are in themselves believers is a little difficult to say.
And of course, now in the 21st century, you know, Ron Popeil's a genius and Bono's a genius, and not to take anything away from their contributions to the human condition, but we throw the word around a lot.
I would add to that list, being in Tallahassee, Florida, and a teacher at Florida State, Jimbo Fisher, you know, a coach of our football team. We do throw that word around an awful lot. It's part of the story. I try to show that in the post-war period, in part out of revulsion against the kind of excesses of the cult of genius and the experience with the Nazis first and foremost, there's an attempt to sort of democratize and to pluralize the notion. Some of this genius science that I talked about before is implicated, as I say, in racist understandings, in misogynist understandings. The history of genius, in fact, is the history of men, not because there aren't brilliant and creative women out there, but because the cult of genius is, as academics like to say, gendered male, right? Mm-hmm. And so in sort of response to that, in the post-war period, there's an attempt to pluralize normalize the concept. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. As you say, we use the term all the time. And in fact, I pointed out at the end of the book, there's a whole self-help literature out there now, you know, effectively saying you too can be a genius, right? Learn to think like Leonardo da Vinci in 10 easy steps and so on and so forth. And on the one hand, I think this is a good thing. I think that we've taken from the notion of an extraordinary or godlike individual some of its power, which is potentially dangerous. On the other hand, I think, you know, when you completely flatten and relativize and lose the ability to see and marvel before truly extraordinary accomplishment, you lose something. And, you know, that's the time in which we live.
How do academics talk about genius? Is this something that people in your profession tend to be very skeptical about?
They sure do. And in fact, I wrote a cover story for the Chronicle of Higher Education a few weeks ago on precisely this. And in keeping with just the democratization and pluralization of genius that I just discussed, there was an attempt on the one hand to kind of extend the scholarly realm of inquiry to peoples who had been marginalized and disenfranchised after the Second World War, and that's all for the good. But there was also a great suspicion of genius as being implicated in these, you know, unsavory notions, and as a consequence, a tendency just to dismiss it altogether. The great example of this is the study of Shakespeare. You know, for a long time, there were more works devoted to showing how Shakespeare either wasn't Shakespeare or wasn't really all that different from his contemporaries than from showing that what he was, an extraordinary and incredibly gifted and talented writer. And so I think that sort of distrust of genius is beginning to dissipate a little bit, and we may be on the brink of kind of recovering a new and improved notion of genius, but who knows? We'll see.
Does it still have the potential for danger that it once did?
Well, perhaps. I mean, I think that whenever you ascribe godlike power to individuals, you do something dangerous. I like to feel that, you know, at least in the West, broadly conceived, in the post-war period, we were skeptical enough of this kind of attribution. But clearly there are lots of places in the world where, well after 1945, people are described as geniuses. I'm sure that the president of North Korea is being described as a genius as we speak. And so there's still that potential, yes. And who knows how it will be recovered in the future. Perhaps with, you know, a genetic engineering, we'll just be able to create individuals who are have such fast processors that they'll be completely different from you or I, and we'll bow down before them. But that's in the realm of science fiction and not history.
If you could choose to swallow a pill and become a recognized genius, is it something that you would accept or that you would run 10 miles away from?
A recognized genius. I think becoming a recognized genius is akin to becoming a celebrity. And in fact, that's another theme that I trace in the book, that the modern notion of celebrity emerges at just at the same time as a genius. And I think we've really blurred those lines entirely. And, you know, speaking personally, I value my independent, quiet time. And so being a celebrity, I think, would be more of a burden than anything. So it'd be great to get, you know, nice tables at restaurants. But other than that, I think I'll pass.
So you think when people wish for genius, often what they're really wishing for is fame and fortune?
I think today that's largely the case, right? And the people who are really after, you know, genius in an older sense, they don't care so much. They care about their work, they care about their creativity, they care about their productions. And so the accolades and the monikers on top of that are not what are driving them. And if, in fact, that is what is driving you, chances are you're not aspiring to genius.
Darren M. McMahon is professor of history at Florida State University. His new book is called Divine Fury, A History of Genius. Darren, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.